Money FM 89.3, the best of Saturday mornings. International News Review.
Welcome back to the show. Time for our international news review with Angela Mancini, partner and head of APAC Markets at Control Risks. Good morning, Angela. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. It's great to be back.
Great to have you with us. And we've got a lot of VIPs, VIPs, very important people in town this week in the defense community. The Shangri-La, annual Shangri-La Dialogues happening. Tell us, first of all, what is the Shangri-La Dialogues?
Yeah, so the Shangri-La Dialogue, this is actually the 20th anniversary of it, so it's a really big deal this year in particular. So it's basically a vehicle for which defense ministers from the U.S., China, across the region can get together and talk about issues, right? There's a lot to be said in the formal agenda, of course, as we know. Anthony Albanese spoke last night, the Australian leader there. And then we've got U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin speaking today, and then General Li Shangfu from China speaking tomorrow. So really a big forum for these leaders to come and talk about what's happening with defense and security policy. But as always with any of these events, what's also just as important are the bilaterals that happen on the side, right? Mm-hmm. So interestingly to see things like the deputy defense minister from Ukraine is here trying to shore up support for what they're trying to do with Russia. Speaking on a panel with a representative from Indonesia who's been silent, of course, on the war there. So interesting to see Ukraine try to tee up some support from a lot of the countries around ASEAN that have not come out on either side of that war. But really, Shangri-La, I think, this year in particular, it's a big one, 550 delegates from over 40 countries. It's all eyes are focused on U.S., China, and the issue of, you know, will the two meet? Won't they meet? They're not going to formally meet, but they did shake hands and smile, as you might have seen on social media overnight.
Okay.
But some, you know, hope that there's at least some breaking of the ice around these discussions with them.
Yeah. Well, it's been reported, as you said, the Pentagon reported that the two respective defense ministers will not be meeting, Li Shangfu and Lloyd Austin. But how much should we read into that? Because they have been meeting, haven't they, in different capacities in recent weeks. I know that China said they want to meet, I think it's with John Kerry, to talk about climate change. There's been other meetings. So more broadly, are we seeing a slight thawing in tensions between the two now?
Yeah, I certainly would hope so. I think that there's more of a thawing than going the other direction since the balloon incident. You're right. Jake Sullivan did recently meet with the top foreign minister from China, Wang Yi, and there's been meetings on the economic side. So I think it's a little bit disappointing to some that there's not a formal meeting between the two defense representatives here this week. But again, I think they did meet and shake hands. I do think it speaks what you're describing. So an overall slight improvement perhaps in relations. I know there's going to be a lot of active diplomacy in the run-up now to the G20, and the Biden administration's focused on that. But I think the important thing to note is the other 38 some odd countries attending are all hoping that there's some stronger relationship building there as well, because, you know, everyone's mind is just making sure that we've got strong diplomacy as it relates to security in the region.
Yeah. I mean, looking at it in a more long-term perspective, it's in the interest of both countries, isn't it? You've got the U.S. dealing with the inflationary fallout from the Ukraine war. You've got China dealing with a much slower than anticipated COVID recovery. So from an economic standpoint, greater communication will be beneficial to both parties moving forward.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's true for politics, and that's true for business as well. I mean, Control Risk works obviously with, you know, a lot of the Fortune 500, and a lot of businesses here in this region are very keen to make sure that, you know, it's hard enough, as we've discussed before, to make profits in these days with needing dual supply chains and with everything else that's going on post-COVID. And the more that we can dial down the uncertainty as it relates to any kind of political situation, the better. I do think some notable things to watch for out of the Shangri-La Dialogue. You may have seen that, last month, China agreed with Japan to have a communications hotline open, and they just announced in the last day or so the same with Singapore, between China and Singapore. Mm-hmm. So really what a lot of people are watching at a minimum is some kind of discussion in the coming weeks or months around, can the U.S. and China open up that communication hotline as well? Because, again, the point is, again, whether it's politics or business, just dialing down the temperature a bit and just having the ability to communicate, which really, I guess, underscores what the Shangri-La Dialogue is all about, right? It's opening up that communication.
among others, folks in town from Canada, Germany, New Zealand, Qatar, Sweden. You mentioned Ukraine, Britain, Brunei, the Philippines. It's really quite a meeting of who's who in that military-industrial complex world that everyone is occupying these days. One would hope that there might be some more meeting of the minds on what's happening in the South China Sea. There are always challenges there. We know between Vietnam and the Philippines and Taiwan and the U.S. and China. So let's hope that they are also having some good communication around those potential flashpoints as well, just to make sure that we can all live in peace and harmony. And speaking of peace and harmony, the Democrats and the Republicans in peace and harmony nearly again as they vote to raise the debt ceiling in the U.S. First of all, a brief overview why this is important. Why should people in Singapore care about the U.S. and its debt ceiling?
Yeah, they should care. It gets so much press in the States. It gets press here as well. Why should they care? Because if there is a problem with the U.S. raising its debt ceiling, which, by the way, the first time they had a crisis, I look back, was 1953, 70 years ago, when Eisenhower was president in the wake of World War II, was the first time that the U.S. kind of decided, wait, we can have an argument about debt ceiling. It's a very convenient way to slam the current president.
Yeah.
Looks like a lot of domestic politics. Why does Asia care? Why does Singapore care? Because if the U.S. does come close to or struggles with actually passing the raising of the debt ceiling, massive financial shocks, potential job losses and recession in the States could have spillover effects. You may remember the last big almost crisis we had was in 2011, where S&P actually downgraded the credit of the United States. And at the time, China came out and said domestic politics is holding the global economy hostage. And they went on to say, isn't this an argument that the U.S. dollar should not be the reserve currency because we're all kind of beholden to the U.S. dollar?
Yeah.
But, you know, what's happening there with U.S. governance? So I do think, you know, this time around, I was at a CEO roundtable last week, 90 minutes, open agenda, talk about what's on your mind. And the debt limit did not come up. I couldn't believe it. And so at minute 89 of this session, I raised my hand and I said, does anyone care about the debt limit? And these were mainly CEOs from European companies. And they said, it's going to get fixed. So I think this time around, there was a lot of assumption that
is it the boy crying wolf kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly. It's nothing's going to happen. But I think the real takeaway here is, you know, the fight keeps coming. This is not a new thing. It's going to keep coming. And the closer and closer we get to having an actual problem, you know, is very dangerous because, you know, essentially the domestic, the fact that the U.S. can't get a grip on how it governs this is not a good look internationally right at a time when it's trying to, you know, portray a really strong, credible, reliable partnership status across a range of political and security issues across Asia, and not being able to tackle their own domestic issues in a coherent way is not a good look.
But it's interesting when you said that the European, predominantly European CEOs felt that it was going to be fixed. Of course, Joe Biden got elected on this idea of bipartisanship. He was going to be the guy to cross the divide. And he's been saying that this week. There were compromises made on both sides, as expected. But how do you see this from Joe Biden's perspective? A victory for him or not?
Absolutely. I think so. I mean, he got it done. You know, everyone's unhappy, right? In terms of people in the House and the Senate.
Which tells you they're probably doing something right.
Yeah, it tells you
both sides are not happy with the final deal,
exactly.
Right?
But he got a deal done, and it, you know, we didn't see the stock market drop. We didn't see anything massive happen. So I think ultimately it's a win for Biden. But again, internationally, it just if you take a step back, I just think it makes it's not a good look for the U.S. in terms of, again, just trying to be a credible, reliable partner in the region and a country that is trying to demonstrate that it can govern itself effectively. It's an own goal, right, to use a sports analogy.
Is it a good look, though, that people in the U.S. are concerned about the massive amount of debt that the country has? It's bad from the governance perspective. They can't agree and they can't get together, you know, although they have in some measure. But, you know, there are people that feel very strongly in the U.S., and rightly so, that, you know, are trillions of dollars of debt, over 100% of GDP right now, right?
It's $31 trillion,
yeah.
A figure I can't even compute.
You know,
I don't even know what that means.
Isn't it a good sign that people are in the U.S. are saying, wait a minute, let's put the brakes on this. This has got to change.
Yeah.
They've been saying since the 1950s.
Yeah, that's right. I do think that's a good sign. As you know, the bulk of the problem is Social Security and Medicare in terms of the budget, which we as a country, you know, the U.S. just doesn't address. So I think it's a good thing that voters are worried about you know, what's happening with the spending. But then I would say, please, let's let that translate into votes for politicians that actually address policy and not extremist views or culture wars. Because what we're not doing, again, when we're all – when the states is, and everyone in government is looking at the debt ceiling and, as I would say, a bit of a manufactured crisis, what they're not doing is addressing what? Structural issues with healthcare, climate change, infrastructure, you know, all these things that actually you do need to address. I mean, it's interesting because clients of ours in Asia are worried about actual real problems, trade, high interest rates, what's happening with the property market. Like, you know, there are actually problems to address. And so, indeed, I think if voters are worried about having the U.S. address this problem, let's elect some of politicians on yeah. both sides of the aisle that are more, you know, the Problem Solvers Caucus, actually. Those were the, you know, the Republicans and the Democrats in the House that actually are slated to, you know, to try to actually tackle these issues, the moderates, so to speak. And those were the ones that actually helped get it through in the House. So let's see more of that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Joe Biden has avoided a federal default. He stabilized the economy. But he couldn't avoid a sandbag standing.
He was literally sandbagged.
He was literally sandbagged. He made a speech, of course. He took a tumble. And then what happened?
So he did take a tumble. And I, you know, I would say, who put the sandbag there? Honestly, someone should get fired. He took a tumble. It's not a good look. Again, he's 80. We know it. If he gets reelected at the tail end of that term, he'll be 86. I think the challenge for him is not just the age, but the appearance of age. Because, you know, Trump is 76. All reports of everyone I've talked to that's been around Biden and other types of reports are that from a mental acuity point of view, he's actually quite fine. But it does, you know, the perception when you have a stumble like that's not good. But remember, he's not the first. Obama stumbled at a commencement address during his reelection campaign.
Bit of an age gap, though.
Bit of an age gap, and he got back more quickly. Trump, of course, as we know, during the West Point graduation, had the very slow walk up the ramp to not fall. So listen, I think this is just a blip in the news, but I think it points to the fact that one of the primary liabilities that Biden has going into this election campaign is his age, because on both sides of the aisle, voters know people that are that age.
Yeah.
Some 80-year-olds age well, some aren't. Everyone probably knows some of each, and I think that it gives fodder to the Republicans to point that out as a real issue. And again, it's not just the election, it's where we're going to be in 4 years and who's the vice president if he has to, you know, she needs to take over, et cetera. So I think it's a campaign issue.
Yeah, it's hard because in some ways it's sort of another, and this is leading into our next story, another brick in the wall for Joe Biden, you know, because of the verbal stumbles, which he has suffered his entire life.
He stutters as well.
And he does stutter.
Which is an affliction, yes.
Which is, you know, that is what that is. But it does lead to this perception, perhaps, that maybe he's a little too old for the job. And, you know, we still have 2 more years before the election.
Yeah, and like, remember, last election, of course, it was COVID. So there was a lot more stage management available to his campaign to have him speaking from the basement, so to speak, and he got some criticism for that. But this, you know, he's out there, and from everything we can see, the people around him, his staffers in his campaign, don't seem to see it as an issue. They're not trying to, you know, kind of pull him back in any way. But I will say, you know, someone did come out after he fell and said, listen, he did stand on a stage for over 2 hours handing out diplomas in the sun. So give him credit for that. You know, you just pick up the stumble. But I do think, again, it's there. It's a liability. It's not going to go away. It's only going to get worse in terms of the numbers of years. So, you know, the campaign's going to just have to figure out how to package that.
All right. Let's go on to the BRICS. A five-nation bloc consisting of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. They're meeting in South Africa now, including Saudi Arabia and Iran. They're talking about forging some closer links, and already it's raising some eyebrows as to, you know, bringing in Russia closer, bringing in China closer, some of these elements that are globally seen as challenging moments to get closer to some of these countries because, let's be honest, what's happening in Ukraine and other places. What's your take on this BRICS summit and the fact that they may even expand it?
Yeah, I find it fascinating because if you remember, the whole concept of BRICS started years ago, actually out of Goldman Sachs, as, you know, basically an investment theory, or just before they added South Africa, but saying, you know, these are the economies that are growing the fastest that we should be thinking about investing in now, because in the next 20 years it's going to be a big play, right? So it never started as any kind of security or political alliance. It was simply an investment basket, you know, an investment portfolio. But what's come, as we've seen in recent years, is the kind of the deglobalization, or the changing geopolitical order has allowed for the rise of some different economic and political groupings, right? We've seen on the security side things like the Quad and AUKUS, and now we're seeing on the political side, you know, entities like BRICS. So what I find fascinating about this is the foreign ministers met, indeed, this week in Cape Town. Russia's a part of that, of course. Putin has an ICC warrant out for his arrest for, you know, war crimes with what's happening in Ukraine. But they're planning a leadership meeting in August, and they've come out. Why it was in the news this week is South Africa has come out and said he would have diplomatic immunity. And so, you know, wouldn't have to worry about what they should be doing, which is, you know, acting on the ICC arrest warrant. So that I find quite fascinating, because, you know, what's happening with BRICS? Are they trying to become more of a grouping? As you may have seen in the news reporting, they're talking about even developing their own currency. And then I'd also say, you know, look who's trying to get in. There's 19 countries trying to apply to get in, including Iran, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE. So again, if you just take a step back, it speaks more broadly to these different economic and political groupings that are coming to the fore as we're seeing this pretty big shifts in the geopolitical order.
And on that shift, as you mentioned, there's some big names, big GDPs. Is this an example, you think, of a financial economic shift away from the traditional Western powers in the longer term?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it remains to be seen how well each of those individual, let's call them markets, are governed and what's the economic opportunity. And so if there are, let's say, trade agreements or additional economics alliances forged, how useful are those? How lucrative are those for those involved? That remains to be seen. I mean, the biggest trading partners are still the U.S. and China, et cetera. But having said that, to your point, I do think it, you know, these groupings are interesting to watch because they're being formed for a variety of reasons, some political, some security, some economic, most likely, you know, all of the above. But it's interesting because a lot of countries are in different groupings, right? Mm-hmm. This multilateral approach that every country has to its own, you know, political and foreign policy. So India, for example, right? India's, you know, leading the G20 this year. It's also in BRICS. You know, it's also in other regional groupings. It's also not made it has not come out against Russia as it relates to Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So I think we'll see an increase in the non-G7 countries looking to kind of hedge their bets, shore up alliances with everyone, and take that kind of multi-prong approach.
There's always something happening around the world, isn't there? Which is why this news segment is always going to have a place here on Saturday mornings.
Why Angela will always have a place in this studio.
Always happy to go. There's never a lack of things to discuss, that's for sure.
Angela, thank you so much. Angela Mancini, the director at Control Risks, partner Control Risks. Appreciate your time today. Come back and see us again.
Great. Thanks so much. Have a great day.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download our audio app. That's AWEDIO. Available on Google Play or the App Store.